say it anyway.
Blog Talk Radio.
Here's my intro.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. Jay Netflix will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. And despite the what's going on outside and what's going on in the world, we're going to brighten your day with a phenomenal interview with an outstanding award-winning author of The Interpreter. But before I start, there's a precious little 11-year-old girl, my little cousin, my little niece, Alexandra, who can't have a birthday party tomorrow because of the coronavirus. But she's smart, she's sweet, she's doing her schoolwork, so she deserves what everybody in my family gets, even if they don't want it, a Fran poem from her aunt. Happy birthday, Alexandra. Birthdays are special no matter how they are spent. Spending it with family that loves you, to me, is the very best present. You're kind and caring and creative, too. You're understanding and trying to deal with these hard times, so true. But I know in my heart that very soon you'll see that everyone will be able to celebrate your birthday, including me. So have a special day and know that this is true. Your family and friends are very proud of you. You can say hi to everyone on FaceTime or just call, and laughing and talking to friends, you can have a ball. So precious cousin, today you are 11, so great. Celebrate your birthday and remember your birthday, March 24th, tomorrow. Love, Aunt Franny. We love you. So that is my special wish to Alexandria Rydell, who is really amazing. And now let me introduce my amazing author. This is fantastic. I dedicated your review, because this meant so much to me, dedicated to all those who were killed by the hands of those that were cold and callous, and to the survivors that remind us the Holocaust really did happen, and the memory of my grandmother and sisters who lived it. Good morning, Alan. How are you? And I am so thrilled that you are here.
Hi, Fran. I'm thrilled to be here, too, despite what's going on outside my window. But this is a chance for people to take a few minutes off and sort of focus on something else other than the very dire emergency that we find ourselves in. But me, I'm okay.
I know.
I'm doing okay. Writing.
That is good. I'm trying to figure out the ending for my next book, but I really can't figure out the ending. First, I have to figure out the beginning. No, I wrote it. So, reading the foreword and acknowledgments, I learned that your story centered around someone in your family and how your family members helped you to write this book. How did you decide to include them? Because that was really very important.
Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the background of the story. So who was the real Kurt Berlin? The real mm-hmm. Kurt Berlin was the husband of my mother's second cousin. And her name was Susan Reichman Berlin. I was very close to Susan and Kurt growing up, and I'm very close with their three daughters. Their names are Debbie, Lisa, and Cindy. So what's interesting about this is that both Susan and Kurt were, who were the same age, who were actually 12 years old at the time that the war started, they both were born in Europe, Kurt in Vienna and Susan in a small city in eastern Slovakia called Rožňavov. And so they had very similar experiences in coming here and escaping from Europe in the early parts of the war between 1939 and 1941. And what's interesting is that I started to hear their stories as I became an adult, and there were certain specific parts of Kurt's story that were particularly interesting. And that mostly had to do with the fact that they had gotten stuck in Brussels on their escape when the Germans attacked Belgium in 1941 on May 10th, and how they ultimately escaped as parading around as German diplomats on forged diplomatic passports. So I really loved this story, and it came a point when I finished, after I finished writing for Giving Mariela Camacho, I had several story ideas, and one of them was to talk with Kurt and to get his full story and do a novel based on that. And my wife said to me, you know, you probably should work on that first because he's in his late 80s and how long is he going to live? And as it turns out, she was right. He did not live long enough to see the publication of the book. So what's interesting along that point is that I went to, he lived in D.C., and I went down to visit with him, and I sat down with him alone in his apartment with a notepad and a recorder, and he started telling me his story in detail. And what's interesting is that none of his three daughters, nor his six grandchildren, have ever heard the entire story from start to finish. They only have pieces of the story. The only person who actually has the whole story is me. And what's interesting about that is that that's not uncommon in terms of Holocaust survivors and refugees telling their story to others other than their children and grandchildren, that it's a too painful of a situation of a remembrance for them, so it's easier for them to tell it to someone who is not their child. So I started working on it, and to be fair, it is a work of fiction. There are elements of fact in this. It's historical fiction, but it is a work of fiction. So I did combine certain aspects of Susan's story of escape with certain aspects of Kurt's story of escape. And part of the overall story here, which is the 1945 story that deals with the Kurt character working as a translator for the OSS, actually came from someone else who was a client of mine when I was a commercial mortgage broker some 25, 30 years ago. So that was kind of how the story started. How their children helped me was that, first of all, I consulted with my cousins before I sat down to do the work, and they said to me, it's fine, they're fine with it. In their honor, I am going to be donating a portion of my my royalties to the United States Memorial Holocaust Museum because, A, I believe it's the right thing to do, and, B, both Susan and Kurt were early and large contributors to the construction and establishment of the museum. One interesting point also is that when I interviewed Kurt, and I think I mentioned this in the foreword, the first thing he said to me was, you can use elements of my story in a book, but don't write a book about me, because I was not unique. And I thought that that was such a tremendously humbling statement, that a man who had experienced what he had, especially at such a young age, didn't consider himself unique, but rather considered himself just part of a general group where others had experienced much worse or much greater things. So one last thing in terms of this question, which is that, yes, he was 12 years old. He was 20. He was a little older than that. He was born in 1927. So in 1940, when they were escaping, he was 14 years old. But for dramatic purposes, I aged him by a few years in the story to be able to take a little creative license with what I was doing.
I understand. You know, it's funny that my grandmother, Katie, that I dedicated the review to, I never knew until right before she died that she was my step-grandmother. She never told anybody. My grandmother, I used to hear them talking in the background. You know how you're a kid and you don't, you know, you listen but you don't say anything, sort of? Yeah. And I went up to her one day and I said, you never had children, but she had five children. She said, I was in a Polish sterilization camp, and this is what happened to me. And she told me her story, which I did write in silent voices. I did. And I was the only one that knew it. My mom didn't know that she was her stepmother until somebody very rudely said to her, you don't have to listen to her because she's not your real mother. Her real mother died when my mother was two. But it didn't matter. So these are the things that happen. So this story, like you said, begins in 1945, and we meet Kurt. So tell us about why he became an interpreter. And he got promoted because of it as a lieutenant. So what exactly was he supposed to do? I found that absolutely unbelievably.
Okay, so what happened at that time, at the end of the war, in the beginning of 1945, and actually this stretches back into sort of the period of the late 1944, is that the American and the Allied forces were quickly bringing the war to a close, and they were capturing, you know, very large numbers of German army and intelligence officials, and they needed to be able to interrogate these people. So what they looked for were American soldiers who spoke German fluently, so that the nuance of the language, of the answers that these prisoners gave, would be understandable to the American army and the American government and American intelligence. So this actually happened. There was a whole division of young men who were American soldiers who were brought to Europe at the end of the war to act as translators because they had fluent German. The vast majority of these people were German Jews and Austrian Jews who had fled the Nazis as kids, had come to the United States, and had entered the service to fight the Nazis. So when I was many years ago, some 30 years ago, I hate to think about how long ago this was, my first career was as a commercial mortgage broker. And at that time, I met a guy who has passed away. He died about 10 years ago, who was a very interesting guy. And I represented him in terms of his commercial mortgage dealings for quite a while. This guy's name was Asher Hiesiger. And he told me over several meetings, you know, I mean, these kind of personal meetings where you get to know a client, you have dinner with them, or whatever, you sit in their office and you chat. He told me how he spoke fluent German. He was born in the United States, and he spoke fluent German, but his parents were from Vienna originally, and so he had learned German in the house. So he was in the service, and he was brought to Europe at the end of the war to act as an interpreter. And this was not an uncommon thing. But what I think, as a writer, what I thought about was, what is it like to be young, Jewish, and in all probability a refugee, and to go back to Europe and have to interrogate, or to translate, rather, in the interrogations of these people who were hell-bent on your own destruction, that there's a tremendous psychological strain here. So I used part of that experience in creating the 1945 Kurt character. Now, I have to tell you with all honesty that the love interest, that's fiction. Mm. That is my own creation. But
oh,
I felt that was necessary. I felt that was necessary to give the novel a broader appeal. In addition to which, there was a specific thing that I wanted to sort of examine, which is this issue of those Germans who were sort of caught in limbo because they were half-Jewish, what the Germans referred to under the Nazi regime as Mischling, which literally translates to mixed, and, you know, how they were affected. The other thing that I wanted to deal with, which is I was very specific about this in terms of creating that character and the parents of this character, was that you know, and there's been some books written about this, sort of the response of the art world to the rise of fascism in Germany, and also how the Germans viewed art. As Hitler was crazy when it came to this. Not that he wasn't crazy with most things. So I combined all of this to create this character in the 1945 story where this young man, is picked up by the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA, to act as an interpreter for their benefit. In terms of his being promoted to lieutenant, I did a little research, and it wasn't uncommon in situations like this that in order to entice someone to do something like this in the Army, because, you know, it's the American Army, they can't say no. It's not the Soviet Army. In order to entice them to do something, which could be very psychologically difficult, they would be given a higher rank. And certainly that higher rank had certain benefits in the present, and certainly would have benefits when the war was over and they were released from service. So that's kind of how that happened.
Well, that's interesting. Now, I sat there and I read the book as if I was listening to him talk. And I felt like I was going through the interrogations myself as he was doing them. So that I found very, you know, very, very interesting, and I felt like I was right there. So
then I did
a
good
job. You did, yeah. I don't say that to very many people, but a lot of people, you know, just write something and it's just a bunch of words. I'm saying like, oh my God, if I was the one doing this, I probably would ask the same type of questions, if not worse. I guess they must have monitored what he was allowed to ask. So why was he going to listen to interrogations, and why did it center around Van Houtman, who I did not like, and how did these interrogations change him? Because he became like a different person, Kurt. He realized he wasn't so sure about this.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. So let's start with Van Houtman. Van Houtman is, Van Houtman, you know, it's just a couple of interesting things I'll tell you about this. First of all, Van Houtman himself is he's a completely fictitious creation. I wanted someone who could represent this sort of corn Nazi, this dyed-in-the-wool believer who was going to do anything for the cause, and someone who, in effect, was sort of a fascist psychopath. Now, you know, one question that I pose here relative to Van Houtman is, you know, what would Van Houtman have been if he was not a murderous Nazi? Well, at some point in the book, someone, I think Sam says, you know, he would have turned into this anyway. You know, he was a murderer. That's what he was. And it's interesting when you look at the composition of the early Nazi Party that, in fact, they did reach out to criminals, and they, in fact, did enlist people with this kind of personality because they wanted violence. And, you know, I might say, you know, my wife and I just finished watching the third season of Babylon Berlin on Netflix, and I would recommend the whole series because it really gives a very interesting sort of view of who these people were and how they rose to power and how they intimidated the German state. So, you know, Von Houtman had to be the cruelest, the cruelest, most impossible Nazi he could be in order for this to work. So one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, how do I develop a story? Well, okay. There's a portion of this story that occurs in the period just after the end of World War One, in Budapest, and also von Houtman and Hertz's father, Hertz Berlin, are in they're in the Austro-Hungarian army, specifically the Hungarian branch of the Austro-Hungarian army during World War One. And there's a lot of discussion in the book about von Houtman's activities during a short-lived communist regime under Bela Kun in Budapest in 1920. So where did I sort of develop this from? Interestingly enough, and this is kind of how a writer's mind works, I have some old pictures from my grandfather, who was in the Hungarian army, that were taken in the late part of the war. These pictures often have anywhere from 3 to 5 people in them, all in military uniform. And in my mind, somehow, I developed these characters from those pictures. I know what these people look like because they're in these pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In addition to which, you know, he told me at great length about his experiences in this short-lived communist regime. And interestingly enough, Hertz Berlin, Kurt's father, the real Hertz Berlin, he actually also was involved with that same revolution, and was, as was my grandfather, was on the communist side in 1920. He was also in the Hungarian army. So I've always wanted to use this in a book somewhere. And I should mention that I'm now working on a second book to follow up The Interpreter, which will be called The Intern. And the backstory of that book happens primarily in that period, or 1920, which sort of explains what happened between these guys in Hungary and Budapest at that time. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that inspire me, and sometimes it's just stuff that comes out of my head.
Well, this is interesting stuff, because I never know what I'm going to get. And I have to say, because of this horrific, miserable virus, I reviewed 10 books this week.
Wow.
I did.
Good for you.
Yep. I don't know how I did it, but I got, you know, you get bored to tears. And unfortunately, two of them were not so great, but what can I say?
Oh, sorry.
Well, I don't write negative reviews at all, ever. I just won't put it on Amazon. I'll just write a summary and make people feel much better. And a lot of people are feeling much better. At least somebody is. So,
yeah.
Well, and we have the scene I really could feel and I understood because my grandmother went through this, and so did other people in my family. The Nazis how did they get away with rounding up these people? And how did they prove they were tough? And the methods they employed were horrendous and outrageous and inhumane. So how did they get away with this? And nobody stopped them. That's what gets me. And the fact that
he was
a lunatic and nobody stopped him either. That's what even scarier.
I'm glad that you asked that question. And I'd like to respond to that sort of as a reflection of this what's been happening in this country for the last few years. Part of the question is, part of the issue is, why do people sort of turn their eyes away?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, I don't want to go as far as to compare or suggest that it is the same
mm-hmm.
thing that putting Jews or other people into trucks and then putting them onto trains and then transporting them to a death center and killing them is the same as what's happened at our border. But anyone with any sense of sensitivity to the past and to what happened to us during the war can clearly see that taking children away from their parents and locking them up in a refrigerator on the border as punishment is a Nazi act. So the question is, why do they accede to this? So there's a scene in my book where McLean, the colonel, the OSS colonel, and Rosenthaler, who is the captain who manages the OSS translation unit, they have a conversation about von Hauptmann. And what this basically consists of is that they realize that despite what he's done, he's too valuable to them to be either put into prison or, worse, executed for what he's done and for what he has executed, the acts that he has executed. And to a great extent, and I didn't realize this till well after I wrote it, because I started writing this during the 2016 election, but didn't finish it till much later, during the last couple of years, I realized that this is part of what happens today, that people are weighing the moral principle against what they believe is good for the nation. It's not a matter of what you believe might be good for the nation. It is not a matter of turning your eyes away. There's a moral imperative here. If we lock up children, it is morally wrong. And what act will we do next if we allow that act to happen? There's a natural progression here. That if you're allowed to lock up children, well, at what point are you allowed to murder children? And why is it okay? Every time we're in a terrible crisis, and every time the professed leader of the free world refers to the coronavirus as a China or Chinese virus, he is committing an act of criminality, that he is putting people in a position to be attacked because those who are thinking about what they consider to be the good of the country as opposed to the better moral position may do something that may harm these people. So I think this is an important message in my book, that it is incumbent upon each and every one of us to stand up and be counted. I've written several books now and short stories that have dealt with the Holocaust. And my first book, Forgiving Maximal Rothman, dealt with refugees, and this deals with refugees, the interpreter. And what I've come to understand is that, first of all, the vast majority of people who either were murdered in the Holocaust or those who survived or escaped as refugees, they were no different than you and me. They were members of a society. They were citizens of a nation. They spoke the language of the nation. They dressed the same as their neighbors. They were business people. They were educated people. They were tradesmen. They were no different than the non-Jewish Germans or the non-Jewish French or whatever you want to, whichever country you'd like to talk about. And that one day they woke up and they were pariahs. Now, the secret, and I'll put that in quotes, of having the ability to escape, to become a refugee, I've learned, what I've come to learn is it really rested upon three things. First was a little luck, B was a little money, and C was the help of a Gentile. Every story that I have heard that resulted in the successful escape of someone from Nazi Europe has those three components. And it's important to keep that in mind, that there were those in each of the in these societies that were controlled by the Nazis who said enough is enough, and they did what they could do is a small act of resistance to help someone who was their neighbor or their friend. And that's to be commended. And there's a point in my book where I talk about this. There's a scene where the Berlins are having a Rosh Hashanah dinner with two other families, and they talk about this. And this is the truth. Without some moral compass, we lack the ability to change the situation. And I think what happened in Europe, which, frankly, I see happening in this country, clearly, again, we're not putting people in death camps at this point, but, you know, what this simple act of moral courage makes all the difference. And there were those who did, but many, many turned the other way. You know, there's another scene in The Interpreter where Kurt goes back to the apartment that he lived in with the Mandelbaums, and there's a woman living there with her family, and, you know, after at the end of their conversation, she says, well, you know, we didn't really know what was happening, and we suffered a lot, too. No, you didn't suffer a lot, too. You may have suffered, but you didn't end up in a death camp. So, you know, we need to keep this in mind, that it is our imperative, and it is imperative upon us, to do something to stop these kinds of things from happening.
I know, there's too much that's happened. So let me go back to Kurt, because I have a couple more questions. I have too many questions this time, I have to tell you. I'm going to over to this. The scene, I can imagine, if it was the real Kurt, what if he meets the prisoner and starts the job to translate his answers. At first he's impartial, but then you can't be. I mean, my grandfather brought my grandmother and her five sisters over here from the Polish underground. He risked his life. A lot of people. So I know that. So what happens when Kurt actually meets the prisoner, starts to translate his answers, and realizes that the memories came back and he can't handle this anymore? How do you deal with something like that? And then he writes what he thinks, but they don't want him to write what he thinks. They want him to write what they think.
Well, that's interesting. You know, that was kind of the core of the whole thing. What I wanted to accomplish in those scenes was for the reader to feel the internal conflict, the sort of internal terror that he was feeling when he had to do this very rote thing, which is just simply to take words from one language and put them into another language in a clear and understandable fashion. But at the same time, it's triggering his own emotions because he lived through this situation. It's kind of Twilight Zone-y, you know? wow, how am I supposed to control myself? So, you know, I gave a lot of thought to this. So what I also did was I read a lot of interviews and articles about people who had been in this program, who had actually done this. And they, to the last one, they say it's very difficult, you know? Translation is people don't really, I don't think, really think about what translation as a job, what that is, you know. You have to sort of separate yourself because you're listening and it's simultaneous. You're listening in one language and you're then answering in another language. So it's a matter of how do the words shake out, you know. It's like I speak a pretty good Spanish. So when I'm down, I visit the Dominican Republic. I just got back a few weeks ago. I visit every winter for about 3-4 weeks. And when I'm there, I kind of have the same kind of thing going on. I have to listen in Spanish and think in English. So it's a matter of getting an understanding of how the words work so that the meaning is the same. Because the word order isn't always the same. So here, what happens to him is he doesn't really want to do this to begin with, but he has an ulterior motive. He has his own agenda. He wants to find Elsa. And what the job provides him with is the presence in the right place to be able to look for Elsa. So he says, okay,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this. And then he, you know, he starts out doing this on a less personal basis because he's the interrogations that he's doing before he's brought in on the Von Halpin interrogation are more sort of basic, you know, who are you, who was your commander, what happened to your commander,
mm-hmm.
who had contact with this or that group of person, what did you do during the war? But when he gets to Von Halpin, he sees a couple of things happen. First of all, the information that he's getting triggers him because he recognizes the information. It directly affected him. So
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, he has to maintain his composure because he doesn't want to give himself up on that because they would remove him from the interrogation immediately. So he has to really control himself. And then he starts to realize that every time he hears the viciousness, you know, it's not just the word
mm-hmm.
Jew, it's the way it's said.
Mm-hmm.
As he hears this viciousness, it triggers him, and he gets angrier and angrier and angrier because it speaks directly to his own experience, which leads me to, you know, what is the underlying issue? And this is what I was trying to accomplish all along, was that, in effect, because of what he's lived through, he has PTSD.
Yeah.
He suffers from PTSD, and every time he hears a certain word, it's a trigger, it flashes him back, but at the same time, sitting there in the room, he has to control himself. So how much emotional strength does this kid have, and how long is it going to be before he explodes? That's really the personal view of the story. You know, it's interesting, I'm pretty involved with the book club program at the Jewish Book Council. And this
mm-hmm.
book will be featured there in April. One of the things that, you know, I've sort of conversation that I've had with people who are involved with Jewish Book Council and especially those who book speakers is that Jewish groups in places like Jewish community centers and synagogues, you know, they like to bring in speakers who have published books, but they tend to bring in speakers who are, they write nonfiction. That they write history,
mm-hmm.
Some memoir, but it's very factual. And so they don't like to bring in fiction authors because they figure that the people who are going to come to the events aren't really interested in fiction, that they're interested in actual facts. What I think fiction offers a reader on a subject such as this is the ability to enter the mind of someone who's in the moment. It's not just dates and names and places. It's how did this young man feel when exposed to those dates and names and places that he had had some connection to. And I think that gives the a reader a better feeling for the emotional toll that this kind of experience would take on someone.
Well, I don't do book clubs, but my two cousins do. And I'm constantly,
well, please tell them
I'm going to have
to
email them.
I'm happy to do a book club with by Skype.
I'm
if they're local,
tell them,
I also visit.
No, see, they're in, one's in Virginia and one's in Florida. And because of all of this, I don't get to see anybody ever.
Yeah, I know.
You know, there's FaceTime and stuff like that. But other than that, they wouldn't even know how to use FaceTime. Or if they don't have Facebook, they wouldn't even know what to do with that either, unfortunately. So there's another character that I found very interesting, but he was in both timelines, in the past and in the present. And that's Saul. He was in the
okay.
past, and why Kurt felt the need to protect him and help him.
Okay, so friendship, particularly friendship between men,
yeah.
is a major, it's a major theme in my work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for literary reasons, every protagonist needs a sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason that I, you know, I have Saul there. And the other is because, all right, so then there's the issue of Kurt as an only child. He doesn't have a brother or a sister who he can confide in or lean on, and he needs someone. What Saul provides him with is an emotional outlet where he has someone to talk to and someone to lean on. And you know, for me, like I said, friendship is a big issue. And to tell you with all honesty that, you know, I have one long-term, very, very close friend, and pretty much the close friend in my novel is pretty much always modeled off of that friendship. It's a very deep, almost brother-like relationship. So also, Saul provides a window into what could or would have happened to Kurt and his family, his parents, mm-hmm. had they not escaped in 1940.
That's true. Yeah.
Now, I should at this point, I'd like to add that, you know, I'm very careful as a writer writing on this subject, that I think it's important to tell stories about the Holocaust. But there is one mm-hmm. scene you will notice you will never find in any of my books, the ones that have been written, the ones I'm writing, the ones I will write. I never write a scene in a concentration camp.
I'm glad, because I can't read that.
Okay.
I literally can't read that.
I feel that, you know, Elie Wiesel said, you can't write a novel about Treblinka, because if it's about Treblinka, it can't be a novel, and if it's a novel, it can't be about Treblinka. And
yeah.
I agree with this, that you cannot write the experience of someone in a concentration camp unless you've been in a concentration camp. So I will get close to it. The closest I'll come is Saul describing, standing on the
yeah.
other side of a fence, what the camp, you know, the transit camp where his parents were sent, what that looked like. But I can't, for many reasons, most of them very personal, I won't and can't write a scene in a concentration camp. So Saul is able to provide certain information to Kurt about what might have happened, and to fill in certain information about what events von Hauptmann was involved with after Kurt and his family escaped. So that's sort of why he's there. That's the reason for him. And like I said, Kurt needs someone to lean on emotionally. He doesn't have a sibling.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives him that opportunity.
Okay, well, I'm looking at, I have 1,000 questions here. This is real unreal. So we have Hertz and Bertha.
Mm-hmm.
And she was an interesting character, and she used her appearance to help her get what she needed. So why was it so hard to get papers to leave? And they had to bribe people, and they had to make sure they had the right papers to get where they had to go.
That was standard operating procedure in Germany and
yes,
in
Kurt.
Other countries, you know, sort of Hungary, the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia
mm-hmm.
in general,
mm-hmm.
France. Let's say the more developed, more liberal portions of Europe. Let's kind of take Poland and occupied Russia and Romania and these countries out of the equation. Let's talk about places that were more sort of, I hate to use this term, I don't want to say first world, but just they were more based in liberal, that small L democracy. They had been republics and they'd been conquered by the Germans. The Germans in particular used these kinds of legal maneuvers to screw people up. So let's talk specifically about Germany and Austria after Austria became part of Germany. The game was to strip the Jews, initially, long before the final solution, was to strip the Jews of their wealth, or their personal
mm-hmm.
wealth. So you needed documents. The Germans loved documents. You had to get the right documents. You had to get them within a certain time frame. Then you had to leave within a certain time frame where the documents would expire, and then you'd have to do it all over again. And each one of these documents cost money. In order to get the documents, you'd have to pay a bribe. This was a way of ensuring that you stripped these people of everything that they had. Because even if you took their wealth and you converted it to a portable means, say gold coins or diamonds, well, we don't want them transporting the gold coins or the diamonds in the lining of
mm-hmm.
their coat out or in their girdles out of the country. We want them to leave it here. So we force them to use as much of it as they have to in order to leave, so they have to leave penniless.
Mm-hmm.
It's a psychological war. It's breaking down the individual. It's convincing them that they are nothing. You know, it's interesting. The word for extermination in German
mm-hmm.
is Vernichtung. To
mm-hmm.
make nothing of something. That's it, to make nothing of something. It's not just to kill someone, it's to erase them.
That's right.
And that's exactly what they wanted to do. So when there's a scene where Bertha's alone, and she thinks to herself, and she says, "They can take my things, but they can't take my memories."
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a very important concept, because if my house was on fire, what's the first thing I would grab? My books of photographs, memories.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things I don't want to lose. She realizes that when she leaves, she will not have the photographs. She won't have the photos, which is why she runs back to take this photo album, and she hides the photo album in her suitcase. The goal was to make the exit as difficult as possible. It was to break down the human being. It's to make them feel less than human. You know, and she fortunately had the ability to maneuver in this Nazi-controlled society after they took control, because she was fair-haired, she looked Aryan,
mm-hmm.
she looked Aryan, blue eyes, blonde hair, she looked like them. She spoke German perfectly because she was born and raised in Vienna, and she didn't come from a working-class background. She came from a wealthy background.
Mm-hmm.
So she could fit in easily with these people. You know, that's why they had to, years later, they had to wear a star. And in occupied countries, even in Germany, Jews were forced to wear a star so they could be easily identified, because so many of them looked exactly like Germans. I mean, we should ask ourselves the question, there are Jewish communities all over the world. So clearly, Jews whose families have been in Iran for, 1,000 years look different than Jews whose family has been in Germany for 1,000 years. And why is that? Because the truth of the Jewish experience is that intermarriage is a fact of Jewish history. So we intermarry with the local populations, and we take on the physical attributes of the local population because our DNA is shared with them. And, that is why, Jews are forced to wear some kind of designating, badge or such in order to make them more obvious within the general society. So she's able to maneuver this. But imagine, on the other hand, imagine the psychological stress in 1939, 1940, that this woman is under. She's a woman. And women's position in society in Germany is no different than women's positions in society all over the world, in that they are not, they're second-class citizens, and they have to live in a world where men control everything. So it's difficult for them to maneuver to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazi society was a particularly traditional society where women were expected to maintain a certain a certain status within society. So it was very, very difficult for her. But that story is true, that Kurt's father, Hertz, actually left first. He escaped to Switzerland illegally. And before that, Kurt was sent on a kinder transport to Belgium. And his mother, Bertha, who I knew, was left there to do what she needed to do to get them out. And this is absolutely true, and I will tell you that I can recall how she was a very demure woman. If she was sitting on the couch and her bag was next to her on the floor, she would say, "Kurt, bring me my bag." And Kurt would get up, go where she was sitting, lift the bag up on the floor, and hand it to her. That's who she was. But yet this woman managed to come up with a plan to take value, literally gold, out of the Reich and didn't get caught. Pretty incredible story.
She's my favorite character. But before I forget, because we're getting close to the time, the 31st, next Tuesday, Susan Hunter will be here with Dangerous Ground. On April 2nd, New York Times author Andrea Kane, No Stone Unturned. On the 16th, this is going to be very compelling. Derek McFadden wrote a book called What Death Taught Terrence, and I got that by accident. I just said on Facebook, okay, how come I never read your work? Well, I'm really glad I did. This is a story that's basically true. The author has cerebral palsy, and the character in the book tells the point of view from a character with cerebral palsy after he dies. And it's really interesting and very compelling. And right now, Derek told me that he's in quarantine because his father has the coronavirus. So this is going to be very interesting on the 16th. On the 20th, three authors of the Montague Murders. On the 22nd, we're going to talk about outrageous characters, Vincent Zandri, R.G. Belsky, and Charles Salzberg. On the 26th, one of my favorite people in the universe, John Land, Murder of 12. He's writing the Jessica Fletcher series, Murder, She Wrote. And finally, at the end of April, Gabriel Valjean, Dirty Old Town. And that's just some of what's coming up to keep me nice and busy and out of trouble and my mind going. So before I forget, here we go. A character that we didn't talk enough about is Elsa and Kurt. And he wanted to find her, but how come they went to live with the Mandelbaums? Hello? He left. Alan, call back in. What happened? I don't know what happened. This is not good. He just hung up. I don't know why. I got to get him to call back. I don't know. Call back. Call back. I don't know what happened. Oh, there he is. Okay.
What happened there? But you.
What happened?
I don't know what happened there. Can you hear me?
I don't know. That never happens. I don't know what happened that it just get disconnected. It happened. So, okay. Why did they?
You
heard my question, though.
Yes, I heard the question. And I started answering. So, Kurt was sent on a kinder transport. There was no Elsa in real life, but when he was sent, he was sent to Brussels. The groups that organized these transports, they found homes for them in the, wherever they were going, London, Paris, Amsterdam, Brussels. And he was assigned to live with a family that was fairly Orthodox. Now, the truth is that he was not raised that way. He was raised in a very assimilated household, you know. And so it was a challenge for him to live in this kind of arrangement. And I recall him telling me that, you know, he was very unhappy about it because he had a fondness for pork sausage and he couldn't eat pork sausage in this person's house. So when I developed the idea that there would be a love interest and I decided that she would be half-Jewish and having been raised non-Jewish, that it would be more compelling for the reader if I went along with the, you know, the facts and I placed them in a home where the host family was religious. And the host family would have to make some adjustment to having me, because, you know, for Orthodox people, that's the rule, you know. But I felt that it would add a little more dramatic flair to have them living in this environment, and that this would also push her to have to determine, you know, how she felt about it, about her new identity, and clearly we know how that works out.
That was interesting, let me tell you. But I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish house, and you did not bring anything in, ever. Ever.
No.
I don't think I ate any, I never ate pork, never ate ham, I never ate bacon, ever.
Well,
my grandma, I was the only one that followed it. Yeah, but now I can't live without pizza. That's about the only thing I do eat. And it's got to be like cheese that doesn't have whatever in it. So,
when his
parents finally get, they come out and they meet the Mandelbaums, how do they really feel about him, them?
There's no antipathy between the Berlins and the Mandelbaums. They clearly, the Mandelbaums are a welcoming family that they want to help fellow Jews. There's more antipathy with the Seidelmans, who are Saul's parents, because his father is sort of more in the mold of traditional Orthodox men who believe that there's one way of looking at things and that's it. And there are a couple scenes where that comes through clearly. I think that in reality, and I know this to be the case in terms of what happened in this country at that time, there was not a lot of common ground between the liberal and more Orthodox sectors of the Jewish community. There was a lot of bad feeling as to how things should proceed and how well they could work with each other, and even if they should work with each other. You know, it was there was a very famous incident where the Jewish Board of Rabbis, the New York Board of Rabbis, back in the that period during the war, where there was this break between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox groups, and the Orthodox rabbis left the organization for exactly these kinds of reasons. But I felt that it worked better if it demonstrated that Jewish groups, or people from different walks of Jewish life, were more willing to work together and help each other as for common cause in this particular, you know, setting in this novel.
No, I believe that. My grandfather believed in his way, and that was it. He was very, very big in the rabbinical society. He was very big with rabbis. When my grandfather died, there were 500 rabbis that came from all over the planet to his funeral. He was that powerful, and boy, do I miss him now. So, when his tell us why Kurt and Saul didn't give, well, without giving much away. Tell us why Kurt and Saul, without giving us much, how did they make them do things? He did things, you know, in order to get away with it at the end. How did you create the scenes at the end where Kurt and Saul actually did something very clever? That's all I'm going to say.
That's okay. There had to be a breaking point. There had to be some point where Kurt had to take control of the situation himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he does, and he comes up with a plan. And of course, you know, Saul is there to support him. But I think the important part of that part of the story is the realization that they have to come to about their own moral health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they can do and how far they can go. At what point do they become no better themselves than how? So I think that's an important message, too. And then there's also this question of, you know, this sort of underlying question about for both of them, are they suffering from rather extreme forms of PTSD, which certainly was not a diagnosed illness at that time? And, you know, how did that affect their actions? It's a fine line there, you know, but there's a big moral question. But I think that moral question is at the heart of the story.
I agree with you. But before we end, we have about 5 minutes. You know, I have a lot of questions here. It could probably take 3 hours. What I'm thinking is, if you want, it's up to you, because it takes work to do this, like I do. If you pick out some of the questions and answer them, I can post them on my Just Reviews as an online interview to add whatever questions I didn't ask. Because I think people need to get to really know this book, because I think it's important. And I've never done that before, because there are very few books that I feel, I mean, the books I read are phenomenal. I get some really, really good stuff. I read some that are very, very unique and different, but this book, but because of my background, this really hit home. And because of what my grandmother and her sisters went through, and I found out, the people need to understand that this is serious. So tell us more about what's next for you, where everybody could get a copy of this book. Plus, no one's getting this one. I have hands out, but they're not getting it. I'm keeping this one. Not this time.
Okay. First of all, where can you get the book? It is available now on Amazon and various other sites, and from my publisher, Black Opal Books, on their sites. That's Black Opal Books, particularly on Amazon. You can get it in Kindle or in print. And since, you know, we're having, you know, a real problem because of the virus crisis, if you need a book to read, I'd love you to write. And if you read it and you like it, please leave a review on Amazon. So it's available, and you can get it now. In terms of the future, I'm working on a few different things. Right now, I'm writing the follow-up to this, which is called The Intern, and that is set in 1953. Kurt is now a second-year law student at Georgetown University, and he has a summer internship at the Southern District, New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, and it's set against the backdrop of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in June of 1953, and I don't want to tell you much more about it yet because, you know, it's a work in progress. The other thing that I'm working on, which should probably – all right, so there's two other things. One is that the third and final piece of the Forgiving series, Forgiving Stephen Redman, will be coming out in January, also by Black Opal Books. And that is the we'll sort of round out the questions and answer out the questions that were left open in Forgiving Maxima Rothman and Forgiving Mariela Camacho. That doesn't mean that the protagonist, Anatoly Kurchenko, and his partner, Pete Gonzalez, won't appear again. They appear in a number of short stories on my site. Go to my site, ajsadransky.com, and you can go to the short story page and read those stories, and there'll be more stories from them, and they may be in another series in the future. Then the other thing I'm working on is a collection of short stories and a novella, which is set in the present time in the Dominican Republic, and it's called, the book will be called Becoming Bachata. The novella is The King of Arroyo Hondo, and this is a series of stories based upon life today in the Dominican Republic, a place that is very close to my heart and that I visit frequently. So, you know, I'm busy. I'm also working for a couple of magazines and, you know, trying to make a living. But my heart really sits in writing fiction. So I want to thank you for this opportunity, and I'd be more than happy to answer more questions and just I'll send you a note. You can tell me what format you'd like that in, and I want to thank you for the opportunity and the great interview, and I hope that, you know, your listeners buy the book and enjoy it. And you can also check my site for events as to where I'll be appearing once this crisis is over, if you'd like to hear me speak about
my work. I
want to
thank you, too. Basically, if you're going to do this, just write, you know, Fran, the question, and then Alan, the answer. It makes it easier for me.
Okay.
And if you answer all of them, I can do it in a couple of days, in a couple of day interviews. So this way I could just do it. I'm just trying to do things to help authors because everybody's book tours have been canceled.
Yep, exactly.
And it's sad, I know, but please make sure that I get the book first, the intern. No, seriously.
No, absolutely, but I doubt that'll be done for another year. So I think we got plenty of time there. But I will send you the review copy of Forgiving Stephen Redman as soon as it's ready, which will probably be sometime in the middle of the summer.
That sounds really good. And if I need somebody on a panel show, I know who to ask. Seriously.
Thank you so much.
Because I'm
anytime.
Going to be doing some. Thank
anytime.
You so much, everybody.
To.
It's snowing here. I don't know if you got it
yeah,
where
too.
You are, but it's. It's snowing here, but it's really a beautiful day. This was phenomenal. Thank you for brightening my day. Everybody have a great day, and bye.